All right, well, welcome to an episode of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast after some major technical difficulties. I'm joined by James Allen and Liam Flynn this week. Flynn's back after your week sabbatical doing whatever you were doing. But how's it going, Flynn? Did you have a good week off?
I'm doing very well, thanks. Yeah, had a great week off. Went away to... I didn't go away anywhere, no. My fancy woman come over to visit me here in Spain. Had a great time. It was awesome.
Cracking stuff. How about you, Jim?
I am just back from my Holly Bob's up in the northeast. Went to go see a friend of the pod, Santino, up in Newcastle. Went to St. Mary's Island, saw some dolphins, drank an illegal amount of cider, no food, no water. And I'm just about feeling normal now, 2 days later. So fantastic, man. Thank you. I want to thank them both for having me because they were great hosts. But next time I'm not doing that on a Tuesday. Because that was horrendous. And it cost Tino a day's wages as well. So, fuming, mate.
Oh, he loves going into work anyway. So, we're going to go through for the preamble. We're going to do the Ball Chat Prem team of the season. So, a lot of different pundits from TalkSport, Sky Sports have been doing their team of the season. So, we're going to go through ours. And I know, Flynn, you've done some research into some of the stats. So, I'll let you reel off some of the stats first. And then we'll all agree on an 11.
I have done a bit of research, actually, yeah. I dug out some stats to help us decide on this. Amongst the stats, so I just went on like PremierLeague.com, found top goal scorers this season, most clean sheets, most saved, then most goals conceded, because I thought that'd be quite funny to look at. Both most goals conceded, both for players in all positions, and I'm not sure how they rate that, or maybe if someone's mistake led to a goal conceded. And then most goals conceded by goalkeepers. So a couple of things I've noticed while rummaging through these stats. Point number one, Ronaldo is the third highest goal scorer this season with 18 goals in 30 games. And you can compare that to Harry Kane, who came fourth, just one place behind him, with only 17 goals, but in 37 games played. Pretty epic stat there from Ronaldo. Jim, what do you make of that one?
Yeah, it's shit hot. And hey, Ronaldo, I mean, your man's nearly 40 years old, and lest we forget, experiencing personal tragedy at the latter end of the season, still able to perform under dire circumstances and in a team that's underperforming as well. He's not surrounded by the best players, and the players that are there, they're not working as a cohesive unit. Not a lot of confidence in the squad, a lot of trouble in the boardroom, and he's still managing to turn in performances. So it doesn't surprise me at all. He's a marvel of modern football. Kind of surprised that Harry Kane dipped a little bit below him, but I think it was only Son and Salah. They got the joint golden boot, didn't they? So I think it was like 22 goals each or something like that. But yeah, he's amazing. And I think he'll feature in my team of the year, to be fair, alongside a few Arsenal players, obviously.
All right. So who are we going for as keeper then? Because I think a lot of people chose either Edison or Alisson to go in as the keeper. Obviously, Man City and Liverpool having fantastic seasons, but protected by a really good back four. So do we perhaps go for someone like Edouard Mendy, Hugo Lloris, you know, Chelsea in third and fourth respectively, and Ramsdale in fifth? So those most clean sheets actually perfectly reflect, apart from the top two, which are flipped, the top five. So in a way, it's kind of like, all right, your best keeper is basically predicated on how good your back four has been also. So is there a keeper, is there an outlier in that group, and can we pick one?
I think Ramsdale's an exception because Arsenal's defence is shocking, and even when he does concede, he still pulls off like fingertip saves in crucial moments. I think he's a massive personality, and I don't think he was served very well by Arsenal's finishing position. I think he was not one of the few, but I think he really did play out of his skin throughout the whole season. The first time in a long time Arsenal have had a proper keeper. But I am biased, so I just think it's more impressive that he had a shit defence in front of him and he was able to still, I think he came like sixth or seventh in clean sheets. He'd be my pick.
Can I go slightly from the left field here and nominate Leeds United's goalkeeper, Ilian Meslier? So why I want to nominate him, he's conceded the most goals this year, undeniable. He's joint first in that with 79 goals conceded. But he also tops the ranking of most saves this season. Now, and that's with 143. So this dude was obviously just getting bombarded. Maybe he's got the most saves because he had the most opportunities to save, because it looks like their defense is probably pretty terrible. But what's there to be said about that stat, most saves, Bissett?
I think it was David Marshall a few years ago, the year Cardiff got relegated. I think he won Keeper of the Year or something like that. And yeah, generally the teams down the bottom, their keepers will look, it will seem like they're having better seasons because of the amount of shots they get to attempt, saves that they get to attempt during a game because there's so many shots on goal. So it's a fair point. And I think he's a young goalkeeper. I think he's only about 20, 21, French goalkeeper. I think this is his second season maybe with Leeds now. But yeah, it's difficult. It's difficult. So you don't really want to put one of the guys down the bottom that are getting chances to make top saves all the time. And then you could argue at the top that, you know, a keeper playing for Liverpool, such as Alisson or as Edison for Man City, they might only have to make one or two saves in the game, but they have to be focused and they have to be ready to make that save. Do you know what I mean? They have to be prepared, even though they're, you know, they might go 89 minutes without making one, then they have to pull it out. But I'm going to side with Jim on this one. I think Aaron Ramsdale is a fair contender. I think he's a bit of a left field pick going for Ramsdale. I think he has been generally very, very good this season. Hasn't made many mistakes that I can think of. So I think we'll maybe go for that one. We'll go for Ramsdale and goal. Back four. So I've gone for Robertson, left back, Van Dijk and Ruben Dias as the two centre-backs and Trent Alexander-Arnold. Any sort of pushback to that, or anybody want to offer anyone else that should be in that back four?
Completely agree with the fullbacks, man. How can you not have Trent in that team? I think you'd be decently served to use Liverpool's entire back four there. That Van Dijk centre-back partner, is it Kanute?
Yeah, Ibrahima Konate. Him and Joel Matip have kind of rotated for different competitions and different games. So he's kind of like had a sort of like two centre-back partners really in there. So
I think we're forgetting the absolute superstar of Premier League defending, Harry Maguire. Does he not get a start in our team of the year?
Yeah, I'm sure. He's just missed out this year. Just.
Yeah, he's pipped.
I think we owe it to him after giving him shit all year.
We've been giving shit to him. He's giving Let's shit to himself. Nah, forget that guy, man. How are United going to recoup that 80 million? You know what I mean? It's just, he's an absolute shocker. I wonder if they'll sell him in the summer. Anyway, we'll stay on the team of the year. I wouldn't mind.
What about Rudiger? Because I think Rudiger's another contender. I think he's been sort of thrown in if, you know, the team of the years have gone with the back three. Could you perhaps say Rudiger's had a better season than maybe Ruben Dias or Van Dijk? Van Dijk hasn't had his best season in Liverpool shirt, I would say, but, you know, they barely conceded any goals. And, you know, it's the same with Man City. Like, they don't concede many chances, do they? Like, and it's kind of that because they're so good at keeping the ball and putting the pressure on high up the field, it's like how much pressure actually relays back to that, to those central defenders. But I think Ruben Dias has been pretty remarkable now for a couple of seasons, as has Van Dijk. So it'd be between them and Rudiger, I'd say.
How about if we go left field again, just briefly, just looking at some more stats here. Most clearances this year, Pontus Janssen from Brentford, 186 clearances. That's a stat I'm kind of leaning towards.
Okay, what about one? Is there anything on one-on-one battles or one-on-one duels one?
Just tackles, blocks, clearances and headers is what I've got under defence on PremierLeague.com.
Okay, is there anybody that sneaks into maybe two or three of those?
Ooh, that is a good point. So I'll go just quickly for the number ones. Most tackles is Christian Norgaard, Brentford. Mm-hmm. Most blocks is James Tarkowski, Burnley. Most clearances is Pontus Janssen, who we talked about. And headed clearances is Grant Hanley from Norwich City. So as you can see, it's all teams like down the lower end who get more chances to do this.
It's quite interesting, really, isn't it? When you like, it does seem to be that they're the players in here. Like Grant Hanley, he's a player I can imagine like that's heading the ball away quite a lot. And obviously it comes down to where teams attack. If they're attacking from wide areas, then you're going to be doing more, maybe more headed clearances. And if you're against a team that is a bit more direct, then obviously you're gonna have more chances of those. So it's one of those again. Is there somewhere in between? No, not as playing for elite team, but at the end of the day, it's hard to leave out those sort of three Liverpool players. And then it'd be a toss up between Rudiger and Ruben Dias. So I'll let you two decide.
If it's a ball chat list, it just seems too easy. Like I looked at the FIFA list, their Premier League team of the season, and it was just all Man City and Liverpool players, bar four, I think.
Yeah, class.
Like four out of the 15 players they chose. And I just kind of really feel like it seems a bit too easy for us to just go for players from Liverpool and Man City, even though clearly they have been elite and they've probably been two of the greatest teams like of all time.
So should we stick that lad from Brentford in then? Because they finished like 10th or something.
Punters Janssen, let's get him in there. Let's
put him in there. So Punters Janssen and Van Dijk at the back and then Robertson and Trent as your fullbacks. All right, I've gone for a 4-3-3. So three midfielders that I put down here. I've got Kevin De Bruyne. I think it's hard to argue. Thiago Alcantara from Liverpool and then Mason Mount playing just ahead of them. So let me know what you think about that as a midfield trio.
Mason Mount.
Yeah, Mason Mount. He's proved me wrong this season.
Mason Mount. Don't know, man. He wouldn't even get on my bench, mate. He wouldn't even start for shooters. Mason Mount wouldn't. I'm telling you. De Bruyne has got to be in there, isn't he? They're just absolutely immense player. Who else would you have in there? On a sentimental level, I'd like Christian Eriksen to be in there just because he's come back and proved that he's still absolute magic, man. Even if his heart doesn't work properly, nothing wrong with his boots. I'd like him to be in there. And he's another Brentford contingent. So I wouldn't mind him being included. But it depends what you want. Like if we're all sticking with a 4-3-3, limits our options a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, good point. I think, I'd say from a sentimental point of view, who else is there really midfield? Tottenham midfield, there's no one really that strikes out. You know, obviously you've got, they're more going to be like Harry Kane and Son contenders, as strikers or forward players. Midfield, I think there was a lot of people making noise about Rodrigo Bentancur for Spurs, I think, but I don't know how much the season he's done really well. I know there's a lot of people saying that he's had a fantastic season, but he's probably one of those players that's sort of doing the dirty work that no one really sees. But I think Thiago, I think he'd perhaps be alongside De Bruyne. Had a great season, I think. And then it's just that Mason Mount position, yeah. Who can you play in that sort of attacking mid? Who else can be in there?
What I would suggest, and I can't find a stat for it, is a midfielder who wins more free kicks than usual, because that seems like a pretty sneaky tactic, but a very useful tactic to have in a team. And we can't deny that's something that is valuable in a team.
I feel like Jack Grealish will be at the top of that list.
He was the dude I was thinking of. Yeah.
What about Declan Rice as well?
Good shout. If you're going to go for a player that's a bit more defensive mindedly, should we go for Declan Rice then? Yeah.
Declan Rice. And we're sticking with the three in the middle, yeah, just so we can have more attacking players.
Yeah, so we'll go Declan Rice and Thiago as the two holding midfielders, and then De Bruyne are playing a little bit further forward. So the business end, so the three strikers, you go for yours. You pick three that you think that's worthy, and then I'll sort of go over mine. Obviously, you can look at the goal scoring stats, but how about picking a player, because I've got a player in my team, picking players that perhaps have scored goals for teams that, you know, probably wouldn't get as many chances as your Man City's or your Liverpool's.
Mate, Ronnie's definitely at the top for me, man, because Man U are shocking. And he'll make a goal out of nothing. Do you know what I mean? He needs one chance and he'll tuck it away. I know it's a bit of a stereotypical pick, but, you know, his age, where the team is around him, where the clubs are around him, and he's like a certified man. He's as close to a guaranteed goal scorer as you can get, and he's nearly 40 years old. He's definitely the focal point of that front three for me. In terms of the supporting wingers, this is another one where you're looking Salah, really, ain't you? You're looking Bernardo Silva. But I think I'd like Raheem Sterling in there, because he's another one where I don't know what it is. He just doesn't seem to get the recognition and the credit that he deserves. He's always impacting the game, scored loads of goals, and he's still got unbelievable pace. So I'd like him on the right-hand side.
good shout from picking Sterling. He's 10th place in top goal scorers this year. Interesting one in the top 10, joint 6th from a lesser performing team, Jamie Vardy. He might be a sneaky
pick. He's had a sneaky season, but how can you not include Heung-min Son in that front three? You just can't. You can't leave him out. He's joint top goal scorer. I think the assists, he's got over 10 assists as well this season. I think he has to be one of the wide players. And if we're going to go as Ronnie as a sort of 9, I'd like to push forward Jared Bowen, who I think's had a fantastic season for West Ham. Scored goals and assists as well. So, you know, it'd be a toss-up between him. And I think you make fair points with Sterling. I think Sterling's had better seasons. So that's probably why I'd lean away from Sterling. And who is the other one that you said, Jim?
Silva, did you mention? I don't
Bernardo
see him.
Bernardo Silva. I think he's had better seasons as well.
Okay. I don't see him in the top 20.
In terms of goals. But yeah, maybe goal in terms scoring. Of creation, assist creation and sort of goal scoring chances and stuff, he's probably high up. And he rotates quite a lot with Riyad Mahrez and Jack Grealish and all those
other
players.
Mahrez. Mahrez was like their top scorer. I don't know who ended up being their top scorer, but when Pep was rotating him out, they were losing games and then he'd come on and they'd be winning or they'd be equalising quick time. So he's another option. But again, in light of what we're trying to do with a few left field picks, I think Bowen from West Ham is a decent alternative.
I'm leaning towards Bowen. And I just wanted to go back to Son Heung-min. Joint first goal scorer. But how good is he without Kane? Is it more about them two together? Or could he hack it in our team? Has he got the minerals to join our team?
Oh, for sure. I think he's a good all-round player. I think he works well with Kane. Obviously, they've got that special relationship. And we spoke about, you know, them having the most goals and assists as a pairing in the Premier League, right? I think you said that. I think you said that a few weeks ago.
In his Premier League history, yeah.
So there you go. But I think he could work with. I think he could work in any team. I think he's a very, very good footballer. And the type of goals he scores as well. You look at the goals he scored. If you made a montage of his goals this season, like a lot of them are seriously well taken goals. And I did read a stat on him. I think he exceeded his XG stats by like 5 or 6 goals. So he's not just scoring tap-ins. He's scoring really, really good, difficult chances and he's putting away. So great technique there. So I think we'll round that up. I think we're pretty set on that. Maybe we'll put that on the Instagram, on the socials, and people can have a sort of tear through it and say, tell us why we should have included certain players and why we should have binned a few. But we'll move on to the football chat. Obviously, we've got the Premier League final day to talk about, and it was a fantastic final day, let's put it that way. I don't know how much of the games that you were sort of like catching on. I only actually managed to check in to the results. And obviously, the first thing I was frantically looking at the results to see what was what. And I saw Man City 3, Aston Villa 2. And I was thinking, oh, okay, that sounds like a great game. Sounds like it was kind of like back and forth and maybe, just, you know, Man City pipped it in the end. And it wasn't until I looked at the goal timings that I realised what a miraculous feat it was. And the first thing that came to my mind and the first thing when I was writing the script was like, was this more miraculous than the game was in 2011, 2012, the first time they won it with, you know, Balotelli to Aguero and then he put it in. And, you know, that was kind of one of those, it's become a really iconic moment. And I think we included it in the Ball Chat Top 50, I think. I'm not sure exactly where it was, but it was somewhere there. And do you think that's on par? Was it more miraculous, the fact that they had 20 minutes left and they came down from 2-0 to, and they had to win as well because Liverpool got that winner, obviously. They got the two late goals against Wolves.
I had both the games on at the same time. And I think these are, so I've watched 3 Premier League games this season and I'm glad these were 2 of them. They were fucking amazing. I had them both up on the projector side by side. And yeah, it was, to be fair, like it was amazing, even though the game was kind of dead for a good while with Villa 1-0 up. But when Villa got in that second goal, it started getting kind of exciting. And then those 3 goals in, what is it, 5 minutes? That was outrageous. But so me, as being like a very casual football fan, if you can even use the word fan, What was the special? I know about the Aguero situation, but was it as miraculous as this? What was it, a comeback or?
It was similar circumstances. They were 2-0 down to QPR last day of the season. That's back when United was still good, and they were also... Man United were playing on the same
Sunderland.
Day.
Yeah, I think it was Man United, Sunderland. They won 1-0, and then, Man City, QPR.
Yeah, and I think... Well, I didn't watch the match live. I went to Jack's for Sunday dinner. I got into the car, and it was 2-0 to Villa. By the time I got to Jack's house, which is like a 15-minute drive away, it was 3-2 to City. And I was like, what has just happened here? Absolutely. And it was at City's ground as well, which is even more, unbelievable. I think I would give more weight to the inaugural Premier League win because it was such a big deal for City. It was the crowning moment of their ascendancy since the financial takeover by the Saudis. So, and it was just, the commentary was absolutely epic as well. Like, Aguero! And he's ripping off his top and running around like, absolutely sick. But yeah, you can't really downgrade what they managed to do on the last day of the season. Can you imagine being 2 goals down after being knocked out of the Champions League, after surging at the end of the season as well, at home? My mom's fella said you could hear a pin drop in the stadium. It was like just tense moments. So absolutely incredible for them to turn it around. I would give more weight to the 2011-2012 on that, because I was watching that live as well, and I was like, I remember it clearly.
Yeah, and I think it's a good comparison in terms of like the weight of expectation and sort of in this regard, I think there's a little bit more expectation on City to perform now. And we also spoke about them sort of digging deep and playing for adversity and having that steely resolve. And I think this Man City team has showed that all season. As you just said, man, coming back from that sort of late defeat against Real Madrid, which would have been an absolute morale killer. But they showed that they had all that grit and determination to come back and grab those 3 goals that they so sorely needed to win the Premier League. And it was Gundogan, who's like an unlikely hero, really. You wouldn't really expect him to be the player that's going to come on and really change the game. But ultimately, Pep brought him on. I think for Bernardo Silva, had a really poor game up to that point. He came on. All right, he didn't change the game in terms of maybe his play on the field, but he was there in the right moments to be able to put the ball in the net. So, obviously Liverpool did their job against Wolves and that's all they could do. So it's a very similar situation as the one that we spoke about, man, in 2012. I think Wolves went 1-0 up early, didn't they, as well? And they didn't break the deadlock until the 84th minute. And it was interesting. Did you see... At Anfield in Liverpool end, it was a Liverpool fan. And he sort of intonated to Salah that it was 3-2 to City. He was like putting up, it was 3-2, it's 3-2. He had his head down and sort of he knew what was happening. And then there was a moment that somebody made up a rumour that Villa had equalised. And like there was like all the Liverpool fans started like cheering and stuff in the crowd. So I don't know who the massive wind-up merchant. So, but we, as I say, we condone that on the Ball Chat Sports podcast, man. Absolute shithousery, but that was pretty interesting.
That is hilarious, man. I seen there was a image of Matip as well, asking people in the crowd what the City score was. So you could see it's hard because it wasn't in Liverpool's hands anymore, was it? And they barely won the game. So they, it's kind of heartbreaking for them. And I wanted to see them do the quadruple, like I really did. And it's a shame it's not going to come off, but. At the same time, they've got to do what City have managed to do and regroup and do it quickly because it's the Champions League final on Saturday. And this Real Madrid team that they're up against have shown they've got massive amounts of resolve and they've got flair players that will do you in at a moment's notice. So it'll be interesting to see what their morale's like, how they come out. Will they have the energy that they've been lacking at the tail end of the season, or will they still be in that emotional hangover type after losing the Premiership?
Yeah, I think there's a good chance they're going to come out and they're going to perform at the best of their abilities, to be honest. And also, Gerrard's in a unique position now where he's bottled the Premier League as a player and bottled it as a manager. So that's sure. Pretty interesting, isn't it?
Bottled it, This is, but that's the. That is not a characteristic I would attribute to Gerrard at all, man. But remember that the 2005 Champions League run he went on? just scoring absolute bangers and screamers all the way through the tournament. And he was doing it in the FA Cup as well. Like, he's on the floor 1 minute with cramp and then he's smashing in a like the bad boy shot like you've ever seen, like from about 40 yards out past West Ham's keeper. Sick player. But yeah, I was watching an interview with him the other day with Gary Neville, and he talked about that slip against Chelsea. And he's like, yeah, that still comes up, man. Like, it still jumps
haunts in. Me. Still haunts me, man.
It would, wouldn't it, man?
But yeah, let's move on to the bottom end of the table. So it was the first time in 11 years that a team starting in the bottom three at the start of play managed to escape relegation. So that was Leeds. And what a way to do it. 94th minute winner that solidified their place in the Premier League. Helped by the fact that Burnley couldn't do the business in the last two games. And, you know, we spoke about the gamble to sack Sean Dyche probably about 2 months ago, was it now? Probably about six to 8 weeks or whatever it was. Feels like a long time ago, but it never made sense to me at the time. It still doesn't make sense now from a Burnley standpoint. Jesse Marsh at Leeds will no doubt get an opportunity to work over the summer with the team that is now going to be in the Premier League and identify some targets for transfers and have a good crack at it next season. I don't think it's where Leeds would have envisioned their team being when it came to the final games, but like they're going to be buzzing the fact that they've managed to stay up on the last game of the season. And, you know, it's going to be a fresh start for them. So I think we sort of flipped and flopped, didn't we, between Burnley and Leeds over the last couple of weeks about who was going to be there at the end. But ultimately, Burnley had the games in hand and they didn't manage to get over the line. They had that 3-game run, didn't they? Probably about a month ago where it looked like they might be on the ascendancy and Leeds, but I think they got smashed like 5-0 or something or 4-0 by a few teams. But they fucking dug deep and they managed to get the result in the end.
I think they've got us to thank for that because we were saying they were going down and the ball chat curse is real. It works inversely, however you want to apply it. I was quite surprised that Burnley went down, and obviously there wasn't a second left in that game against Brentford for Leeds. So they showed great resolve there. Rafinha, who was a bit, I was thinking, is he like a knockoff Granit Xhaka in terms of his temperament? Because I've seen him in the Arsenal game losing his head at the referee. I was thinking, does that help or hinder your chances when you're in the relegation scrap? And he showed that he absolutely has the minerals on the final day, which is what you want. It'd be interesting to see where they go next season because they took a few hammerings this year, like a couple of 4-5-0s all the way through the season. So the Bielsa experiment is over and they got to consider themselves pretty fortunate to still be in the Premier League. But as you say, fresh start under the American flag, which Bissett obviously loves. And we'll see where they go, man. But again, Brentford, they are like probably one of the teams of the season for me, even though they lost on the final day. Such a tremendous achievement to be coming off a small club like that and staying. And Burnley are going to be gutted because they've been up in the Premier League for like over a decade now. It's a mad shame for them.
Now they had you're right. I think they spent 8 of the last 10 seasons or something like that in the Premier League. They did have a drop down. I think it was about 5 or 6 years ago, but I think they was only down there for a year or two.
Okay.
So I think they've spent about 8 of the last 10 seasons. But I'd say under Sean Dyche, who was there for, what is it, 10 years? And I think, as I say, probably 7 or 8 of those seasons were in the Premier League. What do you think? I know it's easy to say in retrospect, perhaps that wasn't the right decision. But you probably could make a case for it being the right decision at the time because they did go on a few wins. But, you know, if you were going to roll it back to that point, would you still make the same decision to sack Sean Dyche?
No chance. Like you just said, he was with them, what, 10 years? I was going to ask you about this, like, why was it so significant? But you've already answered the question. So this dude's been with them for 10 years. They've only been down for 2 of those 10. It seems like, obviously with hindsight, it's easy to say, but you can imagine the situation with the owners and that fear in relegation coming in the next few games. So they get rid of him. But now we clearly know that was obviously a rash decision to try and just claw back some points. And it hasn't paid off.
There were rumours that he'd fallen out with the board or something. Like, it wasn't football related. It was just some personal dick swinging beef. So it's cost the club now. You know, he was proven year after year to keep him up there. So I wonder where he'll go now. That'd be pretty interesting. Has there been any rumours about him or his next assignment?
I don't think there has. I think he'll probably get a Premier League job. I wouldn't be surprised if it'll be somewhere maybe around Christmas when a team's struggling and it'll come in and perhaps do that job that essentially Burnley needed their new coach to do. It's in one of those managerial situations where the guy that you sack is probably the guy that you want to bring in. So it's like, why do you even make the change in the first place? But I think Burnley fans will be intrigued by the rumours that former Man City captain Vincent Kompany is linked with taking over the managerial duties at the club. So I think I've always been a massive admirer of Kompany, just from, you know, from his technical and his leadership qualities for Man City. I think he's very impressive in front of a microphone. So if he's got a good coaching attributes to go with that, I think he'll be a very successful manager. He's going to be starting off the Championship if he does take on that position, which is always a tough one, as we've seen in the past. But he's been head coach at Anderlecht, I think, for the past 2 years. So he's got his experience in early. Still only 36 years old, which is very, very young for a manager. So it'll be interesting to see whatever he does when or if and when he does get an opportunity in England, which I think he will.
Big fan of Kompany. Would you say you're a Kompany man?
I would say I'm a Kompany man.
what we talked about this before, is it called like a parachute payment or something that you get when you're relegated?
Yeah, the parachute payments, I think they're broken down over sort of like maybe 2 or 3 years. That's how it used to work, and it's just to make sure that that basically your overspending in the Premier League doesn't basically liquidate you as a club. I'm not sure how well it works or the sort of, you know, minute details about how it works. But essentially, it's just to make sure that the club can stay afloat with players on high wages and et cetera, long-term contracts and stuff. But a lot of players now, for example, Maxwell Cornet, when they sign for, you know, teams down the bottom, they'll basically have a release clause. And I think Maxwell Cornet, who's been a pretty good signing for Burnley this season, I think he only cost about 7 million. I think he's got a release clause of about 17, 18 million. So, you know, a club, you know, like Arsenal, for example, I always use Arsenal as an example for players because I feel like that's the sort of player they need. Do you know what I mean? So go out and get him. Do you know what I mean? 18 million quid, I think, is nothing. He's proven in the Premier League that he can score goals. Why not go and get him?
Because they don't like making reasonable business decisions. I think that's probably about it. They're off their heads, man. Their transfer policy is just, it's ridiculous.
Here's one about Arsenal. Was it the last episode I was on? Did I or did I not call it? Are they behind Tottenham?
Fuck off, man. It was the Newcastle game that cost them, man. They absolutely battered Everton on the final day. You know, they crumpled hard. I think Everton lost a lot of momentum after they started from relegation. And I think they just weren't really at the race. Not a lot of intensity there. It was like 5-1, but it was similar with Spurs. They absolutely decimated Norwich, but you could probably see that coming because Norwich have been pretty poor all season. So, yeah, a predictable slip at the at the crucial moment for Arsenal. But as I was saying last week, I do think the club and the team are in a much better place than they have been under the previous couple of seasons, man. So they're moving in the right direction, but Spurs have just been the better team. You can't say nothing about it, can you, really?
Yeah, they've put the results in, or they put the performances at the business end, you know what I mean, at the end of the day. And we've spoke about Arsenal and how sort of poor they've been historically at sort of finishing out seasons. You look back on it, and I was listening to Laura Woods talk on Talksport, and she's a big Arsenal fan. And, you know, she was going through it as if you get me that sort of fifth position at the start of season, you'd probably look on that as being a good season. I still think Arsenal are probably there. You'd probably look at it as being a productive season. All right, but they didn't get Champions League football, but I feel like they're in a better place now than they were maybe at the start of season and definitely the end of last season. I think they've definitely progressed under Arteta. So it just needs to be next year. They competed at the end of the day. They competed until the last game. You know, there was still a small chance of them making Champions League football. So I think next year they just need to maybe be sort of, with 4 or 5 games left, they need to be maybe in the driving seat, for example. I think that would be sort of progression. I think they need to make sure they try and get Champions League football, but they need to get the right players in. I think Gabriel Jesus has to be someone on their radar because City have got Erling Haaland now, they've just signed. They've also got this Argentinian lad I forget his name. It's like, I think he's like Ramirez or Alvarez. It might be Javier Alvarez. He scored 6 goals for in the Argentinian league the other day. So they've got two, I think Julian Alvarez, they've got two very, very good strikers that are going to come in. So why not go and sign Gabriel Jesus? Just to, I think that would be a great fit for Arsenal.
Yeah, I think that would be a great addition. Probably need one more striker as well. Probably need two midfielders. Definitely need some defenders. I know Bellerin's coming back, and Tomiyasu, if he can stay injury free, he's a good fullback as well. But there's still a lot of work to be done there, man, for the spine of the team. But yeah, I'm hoping, like, you know, Saka, Odegaard, to a lesser extent. What's his name now? Martinelli, who I've been quite high on, but he petered out towards the end of the season as well. A little bit disappointing there. I'd like to see him playing a little bit more centrally, you know, using his pace and his natural finishing instinct. But yeah, absolutely. Gabriel Jesus, the way he was flying as well. It's mad that City can afford to offload a player of that quality and bring in Haaland. He was like, I can't believe he's still only 21. Like, 50, what was it, 51 million they're going to pay for him, with like possibly going up to 200 million. That was like the weird little transfer deal they made, isn't it?
Yeah, they've probably got some mad like incentives in there for, like, you know, if he goes and wins a World Cup, then you have to pay Borussia Dortmund X amount of money, and sort of like however many Champions League goals he gets is X amount of money. They'll have loads of like contract stipulations in there. And of course, his agent's probably making a good buck as well. But we'll sort of wrap up the sort of Premier League with maybe, let's go for a prediction for next year. So let's go for a top four prediction for next year. Obviously, you'd be a brave man to say Man City or Liverpool would not be challenging for the title next year. Is there anyone else that can challenge? And can Manchester United and Arsenal like cement any kind of challenge for the top four next year?
I've got a feeling we're going to see a lot more of Newcastle this next season. I'm not saying like top five or anything like that, but the money's there now. Is it Eddie Howe, the manager?
Yeah.
Turned up, yeah. Done a real decent job. Where is he from? Brighton, where he was like a hero there or something.
Bournemouth.
I've got a feeling. Bournemouth, that's the one. I've got a feeling we're going to see a lot more from Newcastle this next season. Nothing too amazing, but I want to put that one out there. There's something in my bones. I don't know what it is. It's maybe the millions and millions of pounds there, but I don't know.
They're definitely going to get Jose Mourinho in, 100%. Bet your house on it, man. He's going to come in and he's going to have the absolute war chest at his disposal, man. Going to be paying lads over the odds. And Mbappe, man, they're going to sneak in. They're going to get him in. They're going to resurrect Alan Shearer. They're going to fill him full of stem cells. It's all happening, man.
And there was talks of Neymar potentially going to Newcastle, but I think they're throwing just players all over the shop, aren't they, at Newcastle? Do you know what I mean? Oh, yeah, they're going to sign this player. They're going to sign this. It's like Manchester United fucking transfer lottery, like, you know what I mean? That every single year, every player is going to Manchester United.
Well, they should get Neymar in. Probably get Messi in as well, just for good measure.
Might as well, innit?
They can pay it, man. Who else? They should just raid all the top clubs and just pay a 50% markup on everything. Just bully them. Bully them with funds.
And PSG probably need to recoup some of the money that they're going to be spending on Mbappe. Like, apparently, what is it, 1 million a week or something? And he gets to like pick, he gets to like decide what players they bring in. And like all supposedly, if you believe what the contract stipulations are for Mbappe, it's a game changer. But we'll leave that alone for now. We'll quickly, a quick mention of Eintracht Frankfurt winning the Europa League Champions. Obviously, they beat Rangers on penalties. I did find it interesting that Rangers bought two players on specifically to take penalties. So exactly what England did in the Euros. It didn't work out for England. It didn't work out for Rangers either. Aaron Ramsey missing the decisive penalty. And then Roma beat Feyenoord in the Europa Conference League final. Last night, that was 1-0. Jose Mourinho becoming the first manager to win all three. All three European competitions, which, you know, kind of makes sense because he's the only person to be in that position to be able to do it so far. I'm not sure how significant that is in terms of winning that trophy, but Tammy Abraham's had a great season there. He's pushed himself into the England team based on his performances. So, yeah, Mourinho, I think Mourinho's done a good job there at Roma. They would have wanted the league for sure. I think they were a fair way off that. AC Milan managed to get that title, but Yeah, we'll move on to the preview then. We'll do a quick preview of the Champions League final, and then we'll move on to the five things. So, and we'll have a couple of score predictions from you as well. So team news in terms of Liverpool and Real Madrid, it looks like, I think it was Van Dijk, Henderson and Salah that were carrying slight nicks. It looks like they're going to be lined up in a 4-3-3. Van Dijk and who do you go with? Maybe Matip or Konate. I'm not sure who's going to get the nod. It's probably going to be Henderson, Fabinho and Naby Keita in midfield. And then Salah, Mane. And I think Luis Diaz deserves a start in that final. What do you think? Do you think that they can get revenge on Real Madrid from that defeat, 3-1 defeat where Lloris Karius made those mistakes and Gareth Bale scored that the wonder goal?
I think they probably can, to be honest. But I've been underestimating Real Madrid all the way through this Champions League run. And they've showed against Chelsea and against Man City. The rest of their squad is a little bit of a mystery to me. Obviously, like Modric, Kroos, they're in there. But in terms of their defenders and the supplementary players, I don't know that much about them, really. Like, there's not that many marquee names, especially compared to years gone by. But I do think they there's an element, an air of unpredictability about them that I think will really... Liverpool will have to be pretty switched on the whole... I mean, obviously, it's a Champions League final. This is game time. This is the big show, the big drama show. So, obviously, they're going to be ready, but I don't think you can sleep on Real Madrid. All that being said, I do think Liverpool probably going to win 2-1 or something like that. Finals tend to be a bit more cagey, don't they? Especially after some semi-final dramas.
I'm hoping for it to be just nail-biting the whole time. Like, I want it to be like 5-5 by the end of it. It goes to penalties and Liverpool steal it on like the 10th penalty. That's what I'm hoping for. I want it to be just an absolute war. But I don't know. What do you reckon, Bissett?
I think it's going to be a comfortable win for Liverpool. I think it's going to be relatively comfortable for them. I think I'm going to go 3-1 Liverpool. Just looking at, you know, Real Madrid's potential starting lineup. Back four, Dani Carvajal, Militao, Alaba, who's been sort of, he's been transferred to a centre-back role from the sort of wing-back role he was playing at Bayern Munich. I think he did play a little bit of centre-back when he was at Bayern Munich, but not sure if he's an out-and-out centre-back. Ferland Mendy at left-back. And then you got, as Jim mentioned, Casemiro, Kroos, Modric, who have been there for a long time, as your sort of like midfield trio, if you like. Valverde, Vinicius Jr. are going to be the sort of wide midfielders, and then Benzema up top. I think the real game changers are going to be Modric and Benzema. It's going to be dependent on how well they perform and whether they can take the sort of key chances, because I don't think they're going to get many. I don't think they're going to be able to create many chances. They didn't really against Man City until late on in that second leg, but they had that bit of luck that time. I don't think they're going to get that kind of luck against Liverpool. And I think if Liverpool play anything like they did, say, you know, in that second half against Villarreal, where, you know, they were sleeping in the first half, and basically the way they've been playing over the last sort of 12 months under Klopp, I don't give Real Madrid much of a shout. So I'm going to go 3-1 Liverpool.
I think that counts as a hot, hot, hot take, you know. That is hot as you like, Randy Marsh.
I'm saying, nah, not 5-3 all wins going to penalties. That's what's happening.
I'd love for that to be the case. Extra time, penalties. Who wins on penalties?
Liverpool to win it, but just about. Just before we move on, could just touch on the Women's Champions League final. So Barcelona, who we've been raving about lately, the Barcelona women's team, who've been just decimating everyone they've gone near, got beaten 3-1. In the Champions League final, yeah. Real upset. Well, not quite an upset, because I think Lyon, I think they're the team who've won the most Women's Champions League titles anyway. But even with that stat, everyone had Barcelona beating them.
That's like, it's so mad the way like women's football, how it's grown, man. Like, it's pretty sick, isn't it, really, man? Was it the La Clásica? When it was like biggest sellout game, like absolutely killing it.
Like 90,000 people or something. Yeah, yeah.
They do need smaller goals though. I'm sticking with that. They need smaller goals.
Raving, man. 2 minute rounds and smaller goals.
Yeah, 2 minute rounds is bullshit, man, but smaller goals, that That's just better, isn't it? Because they're shorter.
2 minutes.
Just help the keepers out, man. Just help the keepers out. Make it a bit smaller for them. And that's raving. You got to keep it the way it is, man. Have to keep it the way it is. It's one of the only sports where men and women play under the same sort of regulations in terms of like the equipment they use and in terms of like the timing. So I think the game of football should be pretty proud of that.
Yeah, fair. Because I do get annoyed at the boxing when they make them do 2 minute rounds. But I do think this is a little bit different. But entertainment value, you see more goals, don't you? But some of them, they just float over the keeper's heads and they can't do anything about it. It seems a little bit unfair.
It is what it is, man. There's big ladies out there. Just put them in goal. You just got to choose them properly, man.
There's big ladies out there. Of course.
There's big mamas out there. How about when you say it's one of the only sports with the same regulations? UFC, I'd imagine, probably be one of the other ones. They don't have shorter rounds, do they?
No, they've got it 5 minute rounds. Yeah, it's just the boxing that does it. I don't know why. I don't know what the reasoning is behind that. And then you think women's boxing was only introduced into the Olympics in 2012. Like, what? That is mad, isn't it? But yeah, there's loads of that shit going on. Chauvinistic stuff.
All right, let's go through the five things you might have missed then. So, number one, a 300-1 winner at Punchestown on Tuesday afternoon, which was one of the biggest price winning horses I've probably ever seen. I've seen 100-1s, they happen now and then, but I've never seen a 300-1 winner. And I bet the stable boys who had a few quid on it were celebrating, but it does smell a bit funny to me. What do you reckon?
Look, I'm just going to say this once. If we're not allowed to talk about wrestling and bodybuilding, then I'm... I'm vetoing this fucking horse racing stuff, man. I don't know, man. I don't know about Jim. What do you reckon? You got my back on this or what?
Well, I've got nothing against it in principle, but I don't like watching the horses because they always fall over and die, man. Like, they all break their necks when jumping over the hedges. It's just a rough sport to watch. So I think you're both missing the point.
You're both... I think Flynn's really missing the point. The point is 300-1. You could have put a single English pound on to win 300, and you're telling me that that horse won fairly. So I'm bringing in the PED conversation straight in to the five things.
Yeah, well, listen, I think everything's fixed anyway. Yeah, it's unlikely, isn't it, to be fair? But when it comes to like the dogs and the horses, they can do loads of stuff to manipulate the horse's condition. Like, they can feed it extra stuff. They can like shit it up or whatever, you know, throw it off its game. I don't know, man. All that stuff's dodgy, so... I would say, yeah, the fix was in. Definitely go with that.
Oh, dishonesty in one of the grimiest sports ever. Oh, shocker.
Hot takes here on Board Chat Sports Podcast.
But talking about things stinking up the joint, relegation threatened Sarsko Selo from Bulgaria were awarded a penalty in the last minute that could have saved their team from relegation. The club owner stormed onto the pitch because he saw a certain player wanting to take the penalty. And he disagreed with it. A different player ended up taking the penalty, missed it, and then they were subsequently relegated. And then the club were dissolved 2 days later. So I'm talking about things escalating quickly. And I think the bookmakers should be looking into suspicious betting patterns on that.
Mate, that is dodgy, isn't it? Because you can... it sounds like he wanted them to get relegated. Do you know what I mean? Why? I don't know what the... there must be some kind of financial benefit from doing that. Maybe you're just pissed off of running a football club and losing money left and right. But that's more suspect than the horse, man, I reckon.
Yeah, that one seemed real shady. And I think that's going to play into something we're going to talk about shortly about not match fixers. We'll get to it shortly. But... players and maybe managers just taking bribes from criminal gangs to make these sorts of decisions. None as quite as drastic as getting your club dissolved.
Nah, no way. I don't believe it, man.
And I think I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure the player he took the ball off was like a black player. And he gave it to like a white guy or Bulgarian guy. So I'd read on the comments of Twitter, so this could be absolute like nonsense. But I read that potentially he might have wanted a Bulgarian player to score the last goal for the club, and he already knew that the team was going to get relegated. I'm not sure how much truth there is in that. I think it was just people speculating personally.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Maybe the black player was banging his daughter or something. There could be. It's not always about race, you know. But it was in Bulgaria. It probably was about race. But...
And number three, the AFCON ref, Yanni Sikazwi, who was involved in probably the worst officiated professional game of football of all time, has been selected to referee at this year's World Cup. Sikazwi, who is a native of Zambia, he's the guy that blew for full time on 85 minutes. And then they proceeded to restart play. Moments later, we then sent a player off, which VAR instructed him that it was not a red card offence, to which he outright rejected. He then carried on playing, blew up for full time before the 90 minutes were even up, even though they had two VAR reviews and all the substitutions that happened in the game. You know, he's been rewarded for his abject performance. I imagine it's every referee's dream to referee at the World Cup. But how have they managed to give this guy this chance after seeing what he did this year at AFCON?
Well, I think he's an asset to the game when you realise his eyes and his judgment are better than VAR, which is definitely what happened. And I honestly think 85 minutes is a better duration for a football game. So he's a pioneer, you know what I mean? Absolute trendsetter. But yeah, it's ridiculous, isn't it? I think there's kind of, it's like an old boys club, isn't it? Once you're in, you're in. And I think if you go to the conferences and you kiss the right asses, you will get the assignments, which is a shame, really, but sadly predictable. And I think we're going to see a little bit more, a few more unusual antics at the World Cup this year, because it's just all bets are off. The World Cup in winter in Qatar, like, I'm predicting, like, some shit's going to go down, man.
I think FIFA I'd assume that you have to match a quota from each of the confederations. So I think they maybe have to get a certain percentage of each referee from each confederation. I have no idea why they've decided that this guy is the best referee. Maybe he was just having an off day or something. I don't know. Maybe his wife was pregnant and needed to get to the hospital straight away, like after the game or whatever. I don't know what happened in that game, but if that's anything to go by, it's going to be pretty hilarious if a situation like that. Imagine he referees the World Cup final and pulls some shit like that.
Yeah, blows up on 56 minutes. It's like, let's call it there.
Stand up. Got to catch a train in that.
My legs are killing me.
If we assume FIFA does have a quota, they need so many referees from the European divisions, they need so many referees from the South American. Africa's massive, man. Surely there's better referees than him there.
You would assume so. You would have to assume. But if he's refereeing at the AFCON, you'd have to assume he's the best pick that they have of the officials in Africa, but we shall see. So number four, this is another sport that you're going to hate, Flynn. Joe Barr's favourite sport. Kyron Shackleton, who's a 15-year-old bowler for Potton Town CC, wrote his name in history for being the youngest and only the 36th bowler in a competitive game to a clean bowled Alice Cook. And I find this stat remarkable. So any cricket fans are going to have to get in contact and tell me why, or why this is, or why this might not be a fantastic stat. But Cook, Alistair Cook, is the fifth highest run scorer in Test cricket with 12,472 runs in 161 tests. And the fact that both domestically and internationally, he's only been bowled by such a low number of cricketers, I think, is astounding. I mean, just to put it into perspective, in one Test match, you can potentially be bowled by four different bowlers because you get four innings. Yet he's managed to keep it to 36 throughout his whole batting career. I think that's just a fucking mad stat.
Yeah, that's amazing. Who's the little whippersnapper that bowled him out anyway? It's 15-year-old kid who can barely grow a tash. He's bowling out Cookie.
Who knows, man? But maybe he's going to grow on to be Joe Barr's idol.
Look, there's a theme here with this top five. We've gone from drugging and poisoning animals to child labour now, essentially.
Yeah. This is very dark, Bissett. Shouldn't you leave that to us? Isn't the profane material kind of mine and Flynn's area, isn't it?
Let's get the last one out of the way. Daniel Maldini, who's the son of the great Paolo and grandson to Cesar, has joined in the family dynasty by winning a Serie A title with AC Milan. Grandfather Cesare Maldini won it four times with AC between 1954 and 1962. And the legendary defender Paolo won it seven times between 1987 and 2004. And the latest member of the family who He's only appeared 8 times in Serie A this season with 1 goal. Perhaps isn't touted to be as successful as his sort of lineage before him, but 20 years old, already got 1 title under his belt. We'll be looking to become a permanent fixture in the AC Milan team for the future. Have to give this an immense amount of respect.
Now, that's great going, to be fair, but here's another one. He's kind of, if he hasn't been bred to play in a top-level team, he's definitely got the opportunity. You know, a lot of players have it in their contracts that their kids go into the academies and stuff, don't they? Like, Ronaldo's son follows him everywhere. He's been playing all over Europe for as long as he's been eligible to. So I don't want to discount the achievement because it is fantastic, 20 years old, getting a title. But I also think, like, your last name kind of got you through the door before you did anything. So, I'm a little bit wary of his quality, to be honest.
A good point there. As Bissett was reading out those stats, I was like, wow, that's amazing. But you put it in a bit more perspective there. This guy just kind of, it would be a shame if he didn't. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Jim's always wary of a bit of, he's always wary of a bit of nepotism in it. Like, same with old David Beckham's son getting a chance at, where is he? Is he like Miami or something, is he? Where Beckham's the owner and his kid's playing for like the second team. Probably getting a few more starts than he would be if he was somewhere else, isn't it? And he wasn't a Beckham.
Of course. And this is the first I've heard about players having it in their contract that their children can should be able to join teams' academies.
Yeah, I literally glanced over that. That could be bullshit, but I seen it. It came up on my feed and I was thinking, yeah, you would, wouldn't you, really? Especially when you see how sick Ronaldo's son is. He's standing lads on their heads, man. He's actually sick, so it's probably a good policy. But maybe a lot of pressure as well from the youngsters.
All right, and the last one. This is probably something that you guys might have missed on that side of the pond, but this has been like a massive talking point in New York all week on ESPN Radio. It's all they've been talking about, really. But it was basically an incident involving 2 players from different MLB teams, one from the Yankees, one from the Chicago White Sox. And it's been striking up massive conversation over here. The MLB have basically decided to suspend Josh Donaldson, who's a player for the Yankees, after his comments towards Chicago White Sox shortstop Tim Anderson. So basically, to give you context behind it, Donaldson referred to Anderson as Jackie, a reference to Jackie Robinson, the first black professional baseball player in the MLB that brought about huge social change, not just in the MLB, but sports in the whole of America. Now, without this context, a white player referring to a black player as Jackie would almost certainly be deemed racist, isn't it? However, Tim Anderson had recently coined himself as the modern day Jackie Robinson. So he'd already spoke about himself as being in the same sort of, like, in terms of the way he's trying to evolve the sport, essentially. This was in a 2019 Sports Illustrated article. And that article was particularly about Anderson feeling as a black man playing a sport that is governed by white men. So it did have a bit of a, it was sort of racially fueled when he was writing that article or speaking for that article. And so basically the comment by Donaldson was addressed by Anderson following that particular game. And the flame has been sort of like fueled by the Chicago White Sox manager who came out and said he made a racist comment. That's all I'm going to say. So you've heard the gist of it. There's a lot more sort of people that have had, you know, thrown in their 2 pence. But what do you think on this sort of debate? Where do you stand on this?
That was a bit of a roller coaster. So at first I'm like, wow, very clearly racist comment, comparing him to, you know, another player who's black. Then a bit more context came through where Sir Anderson had recently referred to himself as the modern day Jackie Robinson. So then my point of view shifted. It's like, oh, he's calling him, he's already comparing himself to this guy. And then it shifted again because the context of that article was he wasn't comparing himself to him in a positive way, saying, oh, I'm as good as him. It was more like, oh, I'm just as isolated as him. So then it's kind of led me back to leaning towards it. It was a bit of a pretty racist sort of sounding comment to me.
He definitely tried to belittle him in terms of, I kind of read that as him going, oh, all right, Jackie, like, you think you're as good as Jackie Robinson, and trying to denigrate him on that level. It's always, because racially charged topics, it's almost impossible to be impartial, because from that, we don't know what the guy's thinking, but he took it to that area where you could interpret that either way. couldn't you? You could be like, that is racist, or you could defend him, or but you're taking it to that place by saying, all right, Jackie, you know, I would need to have seen it or heard it or try and get a little bit more communicative information, body language, etc. But again, it's almost like half a compliment, isn't it, to say, oh, you're right, Jackie. But if he's on the opposing team, you would assume it's an insult. So I'm always hesitant to just fully say that's racist or whatever. But seems like there's a bit of racism sprinkled on there, man, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, it's interesting that you took that take, Jim, because that was kind of one of the arguments that that the ESPN presenters, when I was listening, were putting forward. And, you know, the MLB have given a one-game ban, which to me, what does that even, what precedent are you trying to set? Are you trying to say, all right, yeah, it was a racist comment, so we're giving you a one-game ban. So we're going to say now anybody that makes a racist comment's only going to get a one-game ban. Is it going to be different levels of severity to this? Like, it just feels like a bit of a baseless kind of a baseless way of trying to combat it. Do you know what I mean?
Well, and also the isolation of being a black player in a sport governed by white men. Hate to break it to him, but that's just like the hierarchy of society. You know, most billionaires are white. A lot of sports teams are filled with players from a lot of ethnic minorities as well as white players. That's something I don't think you can really avoid, man. You know, there's always going to be a power structure. But it's a shame that he feels isolated like that because, you know, that can fuck up your life even if you're a millionaire. So, I don't know. It's difficult, man. It's a difficult thing to try and qualify because sports in general give you the opportunity to elevate yourself in society and financially. But also, there's always going to be that person above you. So it's difficult on that level too.
All right, sweet. Yeah, we'll leave it there. So we'll go to the JAG news. Go on, Flynn. Let's Tommy Howes. Tommy Howes will be very proud of you doing this info on the JAG. So absolutely hit us with it, man.
Don't you worry, man. I've got it covered. So as the listeners might know, we've now got a fourth Beatle in the form of Tommy Howes, and he's been bringing us all the latest news and updates about the NFL. So I thought in his stead, I'd try and carry the torch. And last episode I was on, I think it was two episodes ago, or maybe three even, I was donated a team by Tommy Howes. They're now my beloved Jacksonville Jaguars. So I thought I'd just talk a bit about the transfer rumors, some of the news coming up with the Jags. So I'll crack right on. First important thing happening right now with the Jags is that they signed a third-round draft pick, Luke Fortner, to a four-year, $5.5 million contract that includes a $1.18 million signing bonus. So, you know, we're all quite excited about that in the community. Next game coming up is against the Las Vegas Raiders, who are, I'm sure you're all aware of, the great Raiders. And that's the 5th of August at 2 a.m. Spanish time, probably, I think, 1 a.m. in the UK. And that's an NFL preseason. We're feeling pretty hopeful that the boys can bring it this year because I've since come to find out that we only won three times last year and we're one of only four NFL franchises to have never been to the Super Bowl. And I kind of feel like you and Tommy Howes have stitched me up a little bit here, giving me a whack team. you've dropped me with like the Birmingham City of the NFL. So executive decision's been made. Fuck the Jags. I'm switching to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and that's the end of it.
Mate, you can't do that. You can't switch.
Well, I'm going to quote a very wise man, Jim Al. Good few episodes ago, he said, real men pick their teams.
That's right. Love it. Absolutely love it. Yeah, that's I can't believe you're already saying we and us and the boys are so hopeful. They don't fuck that team. They do sound terrible, to be honest. I mean, not like my beloved Falcons. They're absolutely killing it, of course, man. Can't get enough of the older hand egg ball. I can't. It's immense.
We'd have three ship teams between us, man, because Chicago Bears haven't won fuck all since like 1986 as well. So we'd have three absolutely awful teams that we can root for every week.
Well, what about the Cincinnati Charmolesters? How are they getting on?
Oh, moving on to the featured fights.
What a segue. You know, it's impossible for me to get through an episode without making some kind of allusion to horrific actions. So we'll get to the featured fights now. We'll start with the retrospective and with the names that I struggled to pronounce last week. ONE FC's 157 event headlined by Petch Morakat versus Vino for the Featherweight Muay Thai Championship. First of all, these two were massive. I couldn't get over how big they were. But featherweight in ONE FC is 155 pounds, which is super welterweight in boxing as a rough point of reference. But they did look much bigger than that in the cage. In short, Vino had one of the most foolproof strategies I've ever seen. He kept catching Petch's left body kick and dumping him on his ass time and again. And he did it about 20 times, no exaggeration. And I thought that might be enough to easily hand him the championship. But I have to give Petch his due, because in the fourth round, he did some genuine neo shit. He pulled back from a head kick and landed a right hook to drop the challenger. And in the end, I think that was the deciding factor in him keeping his title. I think the Muay Thai scoring must be that they heavily favour damage over point scoring, because Vino was like absolutely, it seemed like he was dominating the fight, and then they announced the decision. But I don't know, I'm not as informed as I would like to be about Muay Thai rules. I'll have to do some research into that. But the other fights on the main card were perfect examples of this damage over point scoring kind of attitude. A guy called Prajan Chai, who I was texting Bissett about this fella, he's the defending strawweight champion. He walked into the fight with a combined professional record of 338 wins, 51 losses, and 3 draws.
Fucking blimey, that is.
It's outrageous. I think the guy's like 27, but then he comes into the cage and got the absolute living shit beaten out of him by Italy's Joseph Lasiri. The difference in their musculature was immense, which was evident in the previous fight too. Lasiri absolutely jacked up, set a high pace. Prajan Chai was explosive but circumspect. And watching the pre-fight interviews and knowing very little about either of them, I did get sucked into Prajan Chai's big talk, like he was straight-faced, and he said he was willing to die to defend his title. And I fully believed him. 3 rounds later, with a broken nose and Lasiri only picking up the pace, he quit on his stool. And you want to hear the way the commentary team were talking. They were going on like this was the biggest upset of all time. And again, I'm not informed enough to comment, but it did feel like a big shock, because that Lasiri battered him, and he'd lost like 4 fights in ONE FC previous to this. So amazing stuff, man. I can't wait to watch more of it. And it comes on live on YouTube for free on like a Thursday afternoon or something. It's mental.
And I reckon that Prajan Chai was doing the old Pele, isn't it? Scoring goals against the reserves and like counting them. You know what I mean? he was beating up his sparring partners and classing them as wins, wasn't he? 100%.
That's got to be the first hot take on Ball Chat. Pele's overrated, man. So funny. But in a return to form, in the final fight from the main card, Rod Tang, the Iron Man, made absolute mincemeat of the UK's Jacob Smith over 3 rounds in the quarterfinal of the Flyweight Grand Prix. Rod Tang is an absolute animal, man. Smith looked like he was struggling to accept what had happened to him after the final bell. He looked dejected. His face was a mess. But Rod Tang, in one of the most touching moments I've seen, took the towel from the cut man and insisted on cleaning his face for him. And like he was bowing and like at his feet and hugging him and reassuring him. It's like he's very Jekyll and Hyde like that. So compassionate after the fight. But when the fight's going on, he's a fucking animal. So I can't wait to see him again. He's through to the semifinals now. Bounced back well from that mixed rules bout against Demetrius Johnson, where he got choked unconscious in the second round. He's still only 23, 24. He's got over 250 fights as well. So I don't know, man. ONE FC just absolutely kills it. Bringing Muay Thai to the world.
What's the situation with this Flyweight Grand Prix? Is it a tournament for the belt?
They have a Grand Prix belt, but they also have a separate world championship. So, yeah, they'll go quarter semis, then the final. And then you'll probably see the Grand Prix champion against the world champion. But it could be the same guy when that comes. So
it's like King of the Ring.
I'd say it's like King of the Ring, yeah, to be fair. If I was going to liken it to any other traditional sporting event, it'd definitely be that. I heard they're going to do a Hell in a Cell between Brad Tang and Jacob Smith in the rematch. Weird.
That would go off, man. Could you imagine MMA in the Hell in a Cell?
Tables, ladders, and chairs. Love it, man. Sorry, go on.
I was just creasing.
But the UFC was back with Holly Holm versus Ketlin Vieira at the top of the bill at the Apex. This ended with Vieira getting the split decision over the former bantamweight champion. I've seen claims of robbery on this one, and I only watched the highlights, but judging from them, this could have gone either way. It was low on the entertainment scale as well. I wouldn't recommend watching this, to be fair. It's interesting how Holly Holm has slipped quite dramatically since that famous win over Ronda Rousey, where she head kicked her into another dimension. She's like 4-6 since then. So a couple of bad decisions maybe, but yeah. And she's 40 years old as well. You wonder how long she's going to be able to keep competing at the top level. But in the boxing, David Benavidez and John Pascal both recorded wins. Benavidez with a pretty bad beatdown of David Lemieux, stopping him in the third. And Pascal with a unanimous decision over the previously undefeated Fan Lam Meng from China. Shout out to Bissett. Benavidez called out, quote, all these bitches from the super middleweight division after the fight, e.g. Canelo, while the 39-year-old Jean Pascal stands as a monument to the benefit of performance-enhancing drugs and strong genetics. Bear this in mind, Carl Froch won his first super middleweight world title against Pascal all the way back in 2008. He's been campaigning at the top level ever since. I was still working at Mackey's then, and he's been a world championship contender. Unbelievable. And he's fairly limited as well in terms of his technique. He's just strong, tough, and definitely on the juice, as all good sportsmen should be. And Floyd Mayweather's exhibition bout against his former sparring partner, Don Moore, went ahead in Abu Dhabi after its postponement from the previous week. Just look it up. Floyd beating the fuck out of one of his mates and turning the place into a circus. But fair play. I want him to make as much money as possible. He's an
Was he like holding up one of the ring cards like at one point or something? It just looked like an absolute circus, isn't it?
Yeah, he was telling the referee how to do his job as well. He was talking he was talking to the commentators as he was battering his mate. And it's like, what is going on here? But yeah, he's...
And people watch it.
Yeah, and talking about... because it was an exhibition, they did 2-minute rounds as well. And he was saying, no, I want three. I mean, I did feel bad for the other guy, to be fair, but I think this was just Floyd Mayweather getting that easy cash, wasn't it?
This was the one that was supposed to be on top of the Burj Khalifa.
Yeah, yeah. But the head of state died, so they had to find a quick rescheduling, and they moved country as well. So I'm glad he's made some money outside of... Because I don't know if you can replicate the earnings from his career, now that he's a promoter and just a personality. He keeps having to go back and do these weird fights to get the millions in. So I wonder how long he can do that for, because he's like 44 now.
You hear about this an awful lot with boxers just blowing the millions and millions they've made. Do you think he's another example of that?
Well, he likes shiny things, doesn't he? He likes Bugattis and jewellery and slags. So that'll burn a hole in your pocket quick time. He's a gambler as well. The man's a gambler. Pants down at Bissett's, man. So, yeah, I don't know, man. I wonder how long he can keep this gravy train going. But finally, for the retrospective, Joshua Buatsi picked Craig Richards on points last Saturday. 115, 113 on two of the cards. 116, 112 on the last. I had Tino in absolute fits with my scorecard. I gave Buatsi every single round. Now, fair enough, I was on the run, but and I'm sure that's an unpopular opinion for what was a hotly contested fight. But Richards was in it all the way, but I was trying to score it round by round. And ultimately, Buatsi impressed me with his desire to push through his tiredness. It's like my boy George Patton said, fatigue makes cowards of us all. And Buatsi showed his desire to just throw it all up in the air and see where it landed. Showed a good chin, good determination, finished every round strong. All that being said, there were a lot of close rounds, and I'd be happy enough to go down as far as 116, 112 for Buatsi. Like, I'm not married to the scorecard at all, but yeah, Tito was disgusted with me. He's like, how could you have that? But that is how I see it. And I'll be happy to rewatch it at a later date without the beer goggles on. But we'll move to the look ahead. And it's a sparse affair this week, but a treat nonetheless, as one of the most exciting boxers in the world, Gervonta Tank Davis, defends his WBA lightweight title against Rolly Romero, 14-0, undefeated. This fight was scheduled for last year, but Romero was accused of rape, so Showtime pulled it. There were no charges brought, so he's been reinstated as the challenger. I've never seen Rolly fight properly. Just a few highlights. He's a former judo player that made the transition at 17. But based on what I've seen, Rolly, he's big, he's strong. He looks like he hits hard, but I think he's got nothing for Davis. Davis is a misleading fighter because he cleans people out, and it's easy to attribute that to just power. But he's a subtle fighter, man. He rides shots. He's got short counters. And he fools his opponents into thinking what's coming next. And he's the way he's able to accelerate and leap in with punches is absolutely frightening. He's got life-changing power as well. So I'm looking forward to that one, to be honest. And just a quick one before we finish. On the undercard is one of the many Cuban masters, Erislande Lara, defending his WBA middleweight title against Ireland's own Spike O'Sullivan. That's a massacre waiting to happen, man. Spike's in deep trouble there. Lara is like Luis Ortiz, the heavyweight. He's a southpaw with no birth certificate who's forgotten more about the sweet science than any of us will ever know. I'd say four rounds or less for the champ. And that's it. There's not much else on. There's no Bellator. There's no ONE. I don't think there's any UFC. So I'll be tuning into that on Sunday morning. And that's it for the featured fights.
And is that sort of that fight, Tank Davis? Obviously, that lightweight division's like hotting up, ain't it? They've got the fight. Is it George Kambosos who's fighting Lopez, Teofimo Lopez? Is that going to be in July?
He's Kambosos is the fight defending against Devin Haney in Australia.
Oh, is it Haney?
Yeah. And I saw that Devin Haney had to get on the plane on his own. His trainer and his whole team have been denied access to Australia. So I don't know if they're going to be able to sort that out before the fight. I don't know what's going to happen there, but Haney's traveled anyway. That would be a mad result if he's able to get on the plane on his ones and upset the odds there against Kambosos.
Yeah, I did see something about this. I saw a video. It reminds me now of him hugging his dad. Yeah, before getting on the plane. Oh, that is nuts, man. That's going to be a big story.
I wonder, man, because I think Haney, he's got the style to beat Kambosos. But I also think Kambosos is a very a hard man to deter. I mean, so Teofimo Lopez was punching holes in him, you know, and he didn't think about quitting once. Haney hasn't got that kind of power, but I think he'll be able to fiddle his way through the rounds and jab on the move and win a pretty boring decision. But I look forward to that one. And to be honest, I hope Kambosos wins. But in terms of Tank Davis and his relation to those fighters, because he's affiliated with Showtime and because he's it's basically bullshit boxing politics, he's not going to go over to that side and fight until something changes with his promotional contract or he gets affiliated with another TV network. And it's a shame because, as I say, he's one of the most exciting fighters in the world. And I'd love to see him against Teofimo Lopez, man. That would be so sick. That's like a dream fight, man. But for the time being, I don't think we're going to see it.
All right, sounds good. I think that's a wrap, innit? We somehow got through this episode. Because at first sort of 5-10 minutes, it wasn't looking like we were going to have to record because I need to go and sort my internet out, clearly. I think I need a new PC that can actually access 5G so I can actually use my internet. Must be like some 2G nuts. But I still think it's down to... I'm going to blame Flynn. I reckon it's Flynn.
Look, mate, my Wi-Fi is fucking crystal, mate. You need to start paying them bills, man.
It is when you're just on your ones, mate. It's just when you're on your ones. We had a fine week last week. I'm telling you, we didn't have any issues last week.
I don't know. I don't buy a word of it. Everyone hears me clearly.
All right, that's lads. True. I'll see. Are you both going to be on next week? What do we think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, sweet. Might have Tommy Howes back to talk through some NFL if there's anything that he feels that is pertinent to the listeners. And we'll see everybody next week.